and conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, why truth? Why it matters? We're joined by the editor of the Marcaz Review, Jordan El Grobly, who says, as consumers of information, news, entertainment, and literature, we certainly have our work come out for us. One almost wishes there were a magic pill one could take to enhance our powers of discernment. El Grobly talks about the latest issue of the Marcaz Review on truth. We'll also be joined by Andy Lee Roth, Associate Director of Project Censored, who is featured in the latest issue of the Marcaz Review about the new gatekeepers, how proprietary algorithms increasingly determine the news we see. On today's Project Censored Show, we'll talk about the importance of ethical journalism and critical media literacy education. Stay tuned.
Thinkable crimes perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, habitual lies, alibis, disguise, another guy's democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment of our program, we welcome the editor of the Marcaz Review, themarcaz.org. Jordan El Grobly is an American journalist, editor, and fiction writer of French and Moroccan heritage, whose work has appeared widely in the U.S. and Europe in a number of anthologies and journals, including Paris Review. He's co-founder and director of the former Levantine Cultural Center, the Marcaz. That was between 2001 and 2020. And Jordan El Grobly is the editor of the Marcaz Review. This current issue of this publication is dedicated to truth and, in fact, is titled Why Truth? Our associate director, Andy Lee Roth, actually has an essay in this issue about algorithmic gatekeeping and big tech censorship online. And we are here now to talk with Jordan El Grobly about this particular issue and the work that they do at the Marcaz. Jordan, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
I'm happy to be here.
You are in Europe. You spent a lot of time both in and outside of the United States, which also means you have some interesting perspectives to share on these types of subjects. Could you introduce yourself to our listeners, a little about your background and the Marcaz Review, and then let's dive into why truth in this particular edition of your publication. Jordan?
I am a first-generation American born in Southern California to an immigrant father who immigrated from France, and his parents immigrated from Morocco. Then I, in my college years, immigrated to Europe, to France and Spain, and this has been an ongoing cycle. It's sort of a circular situation. I started out professionally as a journalist back in the long ago 1980s, and you mentioned the Paris Review. I did a number of interviews for the International Herald Tribune and the LA Times and other publications, some of which wound up in the Paris Review, including with authors like James Baldwin and Milan Kundera and others. As a journalist, as a trained reporter, you know, an old school journalist, print journalist, in recent times, myself, as my other colleagues at the Marcaz Review, because we're a whole group of journalists and academics, felt really concerned about the state of the truth or the lack of truth. As one of our writers, Stephen Rohde, an attorney, pointed out in his review in this truth issue, we just had a president who told as many as 30,000 lies. And it's important for us as readers and consumers of information to be able to tell the difference between what is true and what is a conspiracy theory and so forth, obviously. But it's getting more and more difficult. And another thing that is disheartening is that journalists are disbelieved. Even within my own family, I've had arguments with my own family members about the integrity of journalists. And I've insisted that I have never met a journalist anywhere that I've worked who ever wanted to do anything but find out as many facts as possible, present some balance, get some statistics. We do our best to be honest and not make things up. So we decided we wanted to do an issue on truth, but you know, it's truth with the question mark, because what is truth, right? There are many versions. I think most of us tend to feel that we recognize the truth when we see it. At least that used to be true. And now we're not so sure, because we have things called bots, we have hackers, we have a lot of government secrecy, we have self-censorship, we have political correctness. I mean, there's so many different angles on this issue.
Indeed. And you know, we cover many of those angles at Project Censored, particularly through journalism, and we emphasize the importance of critical media literacy education. For us, the truth is kind of a journey, a process about how people think critically and toward objectivity, even though that's not necessarily a state that we naturally find ourselves, if it's attainable at all. And so why truth is interesting, because in the last few years here, particularly in the U.S., there's been riffing around about the so-called post-truth world. And so at the project, we've discussed this postmodern conundrum. We don't really believe that there's such a thing as a post-truth world. We believe that there is an objectively observable reality, and we believe that the role of a free press and journalists are supposed to try to get at what that is to help inform people so they can be more meaningfully civically engaged, right? I mean, those are the pie in the sky theoretical ideas about our society. So, Jordan, could you talk to us a little bit about why truth dovetails and is a counter to this notion of post-truth?
You're touching on the extreme state of partisanship that we find ourselves in. It's frightening, but we have to, I think, begin by understanding what we know. What do we know? What do we know about what the government is doing in our name? And what do we not know? It's apparent, for example, with the lead piece in our truth issue by Lisa Hajar on Guantanamo. She went to Guantanamo 13 times as a journalist. Even the very well-read Americans are not familiar now with the 9/11 case. It's almost 20 years after 9/11. We still have prisoners languishing in Guantanamo. And the reason why there's so much government secrecy around this, of course, is torture. I think by now, most Americans have learned through various television series that torture doesn't actually work. And that's true. It doesn't work. And yet we have several prisoners still languishing there. The government would like to try, convict them, and execute them. But there's so much secrecy around this that there's very little movement. The case is still ongoing. So the first step is for us to have access to the information, to understand what's actually happening and what is the government doing in our name. There's another essay in our issue, the truth issue, about the Lebanese truth seeker and journalist Lachman Slim, who was assassinated in February this year. They still don't know the details of his murderers. He was somebody who spent many years trying to get at what happened during Lebanon's civil war, trying to create a kind of a truth and reconciliation commission, which always fell apart. And think about that. We need truth and reconciliation right now for what has happened in the U.S. over the last 4 years. We need it to understand a lot of our own history. The other day, the LA Times published a story about how 10% of Los Angeles's population in the early part of the last century was Chinese. And there was a massacre of Chinese that was basically unheard of. It was, you know, just horrific. And I never knew that in high school. So, I mean, you know, there's just in terms of the education that we get as American citizens about our own country and what we've done.
There's a lot of work to do uncensoring what might be referred to in an Orwellian lexicon, the unhistory, right? As some have riffed, untold histories. And the job of journalists, as George Seldes said in the 20th century, is to tell the public what's really going on. You mentioned Guantanamo. We've covered a lot on that issue. People like Andy Worthington, other journalists that have made a staunch effort to go there and keep that issue alive. But, you know, again, the government in the United States lied blatantly about what was happening there, lied blatantly about torturing, just like they lied wantonly about mass surveillance. And in fact, it was during the presidency of Barack Obama that we'd had this anticlimactic moment where he said, "We tortured some folks," as if to downplay it. Yet, like you said, here we are 2 decades afterwards. This is who we are as a society. This is what government does do in our name. And we do need people to tell us more about these. And this issue of the Markaz, you've got people that are telling those kinds of difficult stories. And I know Palestine is another one of the stories that we've gone after again and again and again, because it's just verboten in the U.S. media to even suggest that Palestine exists.
Yes, Palestine has personally been, for me, the central issue, defining issue that I've been arguing about since I was a teenager. The reason, of course, why Americans don't know enough and don't hear enough positive about Palestinians and their rights is that, for example, the big newspapers like the New York Times, the Washington Post, and a little bit less, the LA Times, tend, when they publish about Palestine, they don't publish Palestinian writers. We live in this information age when there isn't enough good information. Your readers are more informed They understand that they can't just rely on one source. They're not going to just read the LA Times or the San Francisco Chronicle. They're going to read several different publications to try to find out what's really going on and listen to different points of view. I think we try to do that with our truth issue in the Marcos Review.
This is something where, particularly around Palestine, these voices are censored. Anyone that's critical of U.S. policy in the Middle East, whether it's Israel or Saudi Arabia, we know, right, of course, that the assassination of Jamal Khashoggi, the Washington Post reporter, there's now threats against other reporters seemingly emanating out from Saudi Arabia. We see online whether Kashmir, Palestine, Ifat Ghazia just was censored from Twitter, deplatformed. She and Tara Drabji wrote for us about Palestine and Kashmir, these places around the world where we are not treated for those indigenous voices. And here's another example happening right now. Ifat has done work with us before, now being deplatformed and threatened, among other things. So how do you see the Marcos Review filling that space and really being a platform for these kinds of voices, particularly this issue on Why Truth?
We're a relatively new platform. We only launched in September, so a little over 6 months old. But we did grow out of something that was much older, more venerable. We started out as a cultural center, as I think you mentioned, back in the summer of 2001. So we had a track record for many years of presenting public programs on Palestine and a lot of the other places that you mentioned, including Saudi Arabia. And of course, Saudi Arabia, for me, it's as problematic as Israel and Palestine because of the promotion of extreme Salafism and Wahhabism radicalizes Sunni Muslims around the world. As a platform, we are open. We want to find many voices that don't have outlets.
People can learn more about the site, of course. It's themarkaz.org, MARKAZ.ORG. Right now, I'd just like to remind our listeners that you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Helf. We're talking to Jordan L. Grobley. He's the editor at The Marcos Review. That's themarkaz.org. This issue is called Why Truth? And we're going to go into some more detail about the concept and what's in this issue after this brief musical break. Stay with us.
A little boy of three, sitting on the floor, looks up and says, Daddy, what is war? Son, that's when people fight and die. A little boy of three says, Daddy, why? Young man of 17 in Sunday school, being taught the golden rule. And by the time another year's gone around, it may be his turn to lay his life down. Can you blame the voice of youth for asking, what is truth?
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this portion of today's program, we are joined by the editor at The Marcos Review, themarcos.org. We're joined by Jordan L. Grobley. And before the break, we were talking about this particular issue on Why Truth, and Associate Director Andy Lee Roth has a piece in it on the new gatekeepers, algorithmic gatekeepers, and the new forms of censorship. So I wanted to come back to that theme, Jordan. I see the theme, of course, is commensurate with seemingly much of the trajectory of the work that you've been doing for a long time. Do you think that you're going to pick up some steam with this thread moving through other issues for the Marcos moving forward?
I think so. The truth issue is extensive, but it still feels like we're only scratching the surface. In two issues, we're going to do one called Walls. We're going to look at figurative and literal walls, and we're going to look at immigration and xenophobia and just a whole raft of issues that have to do with security, with homeland, with identity, and freedom of speech. By the way, the Marcos is a word that means the center, in case people were wondering, because it's a foreign word, but M-A-R-K-A-Z. It means the center in several Middle Eastern languages, both Arabic and Hebrew, as well as Urdu, Turkish, and Persian. So it seemed appropriate. But to come back to the current issue, I wanted to point out that we had a reporter right from Afghanistan about the campaign of assassinations of journalists there. It's really horrifying. But that's just an extreme example of what's happening to journalists who are being disbelieved and locked up in many countries, not yet in the United States, but they were certainly mistreated during the George Floyd protests. I saw a lot of images of journalists, you know, getting their butts kicked, their cameras destroyed, and so forth. We saw them attacked on January 6th outside the Capitol. It definitely doesn't feel like the safest profession anymore. I mean, as a foreign correspondent in a conflict zone, it was always dangerous. But frankly, nobody ever felt any fear in European countries or in the U.S. And I just don't think that's the same anymore. I think that journalists are concerned about their safety.
We've talked about Press Freedom Tracker and a number of groups in the U.S. in particular. There were literally hundreds of arrests and attacks on journalists just since the George Floyd murder. There was a mass uptick, and by some metrics, the U.S., it was claimed that the U.S. was in the top five most dangerous places for journalists to be, which on the surface of it sounded hyperbolic, given some of the examples of the, just absolutely grotesque and inhumane things that are happening to journalists in other countries around the world. But to see the U.S. catapulted up so high on a list like that, I think is quite striking. And I think that it's really a warning sign of more of what's to come. Jordan El-Grabli, in your experience, and certainly with some of the things that you're highlighting in this issue of the Markaz, what do you think we ought to be focusing on in terms of the role of journalism, the safety and protection of journalists? And how do you think we can fight back against censorship in its many guises here in the 21st century?
We need to reach out to readers and get them to understand what journalism is, the fourth estate, holding power's feet to the fire, speaking truth to power and all that. I mean, those are not just vague ideas. They're a reason why journalism exists. How do we regain the confidence of the public? Let me ask you this. Do you think that people are reading as much as they used to? Do you think that our attention spans are perhaps splintered by all the social media and the phones? I mean, I see people walking down the street with their cell phone in front of their face. It's a miracle they don't get run over in traffic.
Is it that we're reading less, or is it that we're reading differently? I can see just from teaching that people seem to be reading less and differently. That's the interesting thing about radio, is that it's more like long-form communication. It's not the couple hundred characters on Twitter. And we just had an entire presidency that was based on these inane sound bites.
We're speaking at the end of March 2021, and for over a year, we've been dealing with a pandemic, and a lot of people have self-confined. We have curfews. One thing I've seen a lot of people say is that they're having trouble concentrating. People I know who are confirmed readers and writers are saying, I can't focus like I used to. I'm not reading as much. I haven't read your truth issue. I know that I need to read it, but it's going to take me longer. I have to say that this is happening even with me. I read a lot, but I feel like I'm not reading enough, and I feel like I'm distracted. I think that with all of these Twitter and Facebook and the divisive American politics, it's a lot better that now that Trump is gone, but it's still divisive. It's distracting and decentering. It's the opposite of relaxing. We're like on edge. Even Americans in Europe, I'm one of those quite far away. We're not far enough away to not feel the sludge around us.
A veil has lifted for some, even though we're very critical of the Biden administration. What you're pointing to is there was a certain, for lack of a more sophisticated term, just a certain vibe, something quite repressive. And though certainly it's still here, something did change. Although the corporate media in the U.S., they're kind of grasping at straws. They don't know what to do without the Trumpian distraction to lead them by the nose through their news cycle. And so they're spinning their wheels toward the next distraction and the next hyperpartisan conflict.
They love the mass shootings because that gives them something to report on, and people are glued to it, you know, which is sad. But I think this is a time when the LA Times, New York Times, Washington Post, The Nation, I mean, everybody should be writing about stories that matter, and not just reporting on the negatives, but also the positives. What are community organizations accomplishing? What communities are working together? Right now, we're seeing a lot of reporting about anti-Asian racism, police brutality against Blacks and Latinos. And then we saw with the George Floyd protest, there were a lot of white people out there protesting as well. So we're in a period where we have the opportunity for incredible solidarity and communication across all kinds of class and race barriers. I think we have this opportunity. It feels like it would be a shame to waste it. And I hope the editors at these mainstream publications don't waste this opportunity.
And including the intersectional analysis of these recent tragedies in the United States, the patriarchal, misogynistic violence against women. When we saw the shootings in Atlanta, there was a lot of attention paid to six of the victims being Asian, but most of the victims were women. And it was interesting to note how few media outlets wanted to riff on the fact that the shooter there is a white male Christian, patriarchal, misogynistic, access to an assault weapon in a day, and goes out and murders these people. The police officer there, the white sheriff, was said, well, that the shooter had a bad day. media has a place here to ground those conversations historically, theoretically, but also in terms of praxis and action of what we can do about it. And so, you know, Jordan, as someone that's a publisher, how do you hope maybe an issue like this on Why Truth can be an antidote to that kind of malaise and cynicism that we see in the corporate press in the U.S.?
Well, one thing that we do well, I think, at the Marcaz Review is enable writers to tell personal stories while also, you know, grappling with serious issues. And one piece that I want to direct your readers to read is called Dinner at the White House in the Lion's Den. And it's by Francisco Letelier, who is the son of Orlando Letelier, who was the Chilean ambassador at one point, but he was assassinated in Washington, D.C. And the CIA knew that Pinochet's intelligence service had ordered the hit, and it was kept hidden for years and years. In any case, this is a personal story. This is sort of citizen journalism, if you will, because the son of this assassinated leader was for many years trying to get the truth, you know, Freedom of Information Act, trying to get all the documents he could. He ended up looking at his own FBI file. They had kept a record of his father's doings in the U.S. from 1960 until the month he was assassinated in 1976. We are definitely interested in citizen journalism and working with newer writers and encouraging American citizens to take a skeptical look at what their government is telling them and, you know, recognize that there's too much government secrecy that's happening right now in our name. In fact, to go back to Stephen Rohde's piece, the book review that he wrote, let me quote him for a second. He says, "This hyper-secrecy is notably prevalent in the area of national security, where there's an epidemic of overclassification of vital information by the government." There should not be so many secrets. We should know what's going on in the 9/11 case, and we really don't. We should be informed about the behind the scenes of these cases with respect to Snowden and Julian Assange. Right? It doesn't feel good to know that your government can lie to you with so much impunity.
And that we have to rely on these whistleblowers who are then shot as the messengers. As Daniel Ellsberg routinely says, we need more people coming out and revealing the secrets. Even in the case of Snowden, we've only seen a small fraction of the files that were handed over to people like Glenn Greenwald. Jordan O'Grabley, we only have a couple minutes left, and even though this is a harder thing to do on radio, I would be remiss if I didn't call attention to the absolutely spectacular intersection that you have in your publication with the arts, in particular the visual arts. The paintings, the images that accompany this issue on Why Truth are absolutely arresting, riveting, in fact. Could you say a few things about the art for this issue and the way in which you include art and visual representation in your publication? Because again, it's quite striking.
Oh, thank you. Well, I think the artists that you're probably talking about range from Ali Bani Sadr, who's an Iranian-born artist, fantastic artist in New York, whose piece illustrates Andy's essay, and then Tom Young, who's actually a British artist who's been living in Beirut for several years, an Iraqi-American in L.A., Paul Batu, Sandal Burke, who's an American who painted a whole series of paintings called American Quran, which is also a book, and it was a fantastic exhibition. We don't illustrate our pieces exclusively with photographs, and we tend not to use sensational pictures. So, for example, we have this piece on the assassination campaign of journalists in Afghanistan. We don't have anything gory, horrific. The reason why we use art as much as we do is we want people to use their imagination. And then when you look at a painting, your own emotions or imagination are more engaged than when you look at a photograph. We continue to look for Middle Eastern artists, American artists. Francisco Letelier, he's a Chilean-American muralist. Even though our focus is the Middle East and North Africa and our communities in diaspora in the U.S. and Europe and the rest of the world, we integrate a lot of artists and writers who are not Arab or Iranian or Middle Eastern, because I think our message at the end of the day is that we are all in this together. It's not like the Arabs are over there and the Iranians are over there and we Americans are over here. No, we're all intermingling, intermixed, intersected, whether it's the U.S. or Europe or the Middle East. The boundaries are no longer so clear.
Indeed, and I would be remiss if I didn't note, if I'm not mistaken, you did have a background at KPFK, the Pacifica sister station. Jordan O'Grabley, you did have some time in radio. Isn't that correct?
I worked with Don Bustani when he had the show Middle East in Focus at KPFK. This goes back a few years. Now the show's been taken over by Esty Chandler. She's now the host down south. Yeah, over the years, we did a lot of radio with the Levantine Center, which we ended up calling the Marcaz in 2015. Now, that's the cultural center is closed, but the Marcaz Review is sort of taken over. We're no longer LA-centric. Our writers and contributing editors live all over the world.
Jordan L. Grobley, I really appreciate not just the time that you've taken to talk to me, but the kind of work that you've been doing for so long and this latest iteration, the Markaz.org, the Markaz Review. Any parting words for our listeners today? I certainly am encouraging them to become more familiar with your site, your publication, and to follow your work moving ahead.
Thank you so much for having us. I would just ask people to just keep reading, read more.
TheMarcaz.org. Up next, we're going to hear from Andy Lee Roth about his contribution on the new gatekeepers and algorithmic censorship. Stay with us.
I've had enough of watching scenes with schizophrenic, egocentric, paranoid prima donnas. All I want is the truth now. Just give me some truth.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we welcome back the Associate Director of Project Censored, Dr. Andy Lee Roth. Project Censored, of course, has dealt with news media censorship for over four decades, and over that time, the means by which information is controlled, curated, or censored has changed. The end game remains the same. The public is not informed enough about how their news ecosystems work, and they don't necessarily know when or why they're getting information or not getting information they need. In a recent article, Andy Lee Roth writes about the new gatekeepers, how proprietary algorithms increasingly determine the news we see. Andy Lee Roth is, as I noted, Associate Director of Project Censored, where he coordinates the project's Campus Affiliates Program, a news media research network of several hundred students and faculty at two dozen colleges and universities across North America. Andy Lee Roth co-edited the project's newest book, State of the Free Press 2021, from Seven Stories Press, and his work has been published in a number of outlets, including Index on Censorship, In These Times, Yes Magazine, Media Culture and Society, and the International Journal of Press and Politics. Today, we'll talk to Andy Lee Roth about a recent piece that was published by the Markaz Review. Andy Lee Roth, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Thanks so much, Mickey. It's always a pleasure to join you on the show.
Indeed it is. And of course, full disclosure, I co-edited the Censored Book 2021 with you this past year. And of course, you can learn more about that work at projectcensored.org. This time around, Andy Lee Roth, you've written a piece for the Markaz Review, and you took a deep dive into the new forms of censorship in a digital era. And given that Project Censored has been focusing on news media censorship for over four decades, let's set this up. In the 21st century, in 2021, you're writing about something old but new. You're talking about new gatekeepers. Let's talk a little bit about this new form of censorship that we see online. Could you set this up for us?
The new gatekeepers are algorithms, artificial intelligence programs, in this case controlled by big tech companies like Google, Facebook, and Twitter, that use these proprietary algorithms to determine the kinds of news stories we're likely to see and know about when we are on these major fundamental and global platforms such as Facebook, Twitter, Google's search engine. And so one of the guiding principles of any sort of ethical journalism is that news should be accountable and it should be transparent. That's one of the ethical tenets of the Society of Professional Journalists. And what I argue in this article that was published in Markaz Review is that news gatekeeping conducted by proprietary algorithms crosses wires with that ethical guideline. And the result is grave threats to the integrity of journalism and the likelihood of a well-informed public.
So Andy Lee Roth, over the years, Project Censored, of course, has dealt with a myriad form of censorship or censorship in many guises, both decrying censorship while also buttressing a truly independent and free press. So it's problem plus solution. So we're not just pointing fingers up and saying that this is a problem. We're also going to try to come up with some solutions. And we're going to get to that later in our conversation because your article doesn't just lay out the problems. It does. give us some direction about what to do. But let's talk about this new kind of gatekeeping and algorithms. And in order to do that, perhaps you could set up that kind of language or analysis for us about gatekeeping in general.
So I want to take us back to the 1950s to a pair of foundational studies in the history of communication and the sociology of news. The first of these studies was conducted by David Manning White, and he spent time, several weeks, with the editor of a small Midwestern newspaper. David Manning White was interested in how this editor chose news stories that were coming over the newswire. White called this editor Mr. Gates because White's understanding of this process was that the editor acted as a kind of gatekeeper. And this was a position of influence and to some extent power, choosing what stories go into the paper and what stories don't. So White studied Mr. Gates' decision process for several weeks. And what he found was that there were two types of reasons that Mr. Gates provided for rejecting stories as being worthy of inclusion in the paper. Some of these stories were rejected on practical reasons. Mr. Gates felt the story was vague, the writing was dull, or the story had simply come in too late and there was no space left in that day's edition of the paper. But in 18 of the 423 decisions that White examined, Mr. Gates rejected the stories for political reasons. For instance, saying this story is no good, it's pure propaganda, it's too red. And White concluded his 1950 article about gatekeeping in the news editing process by emphasizing, here I'll quote directly, "highly subjective, how based on the gatekeeper's own set of experiences, attitudes, and expectations, the communication of news really is." So David Manning White's study established as a fundamental for people interested in news and communication, the power of the editor as a gatekeeper, and more specifically, that power often manifested in White's assessment as a form of the editor's own political bias, his own individual bias, shaping the decision about news, about what qualified as news.
Andy Lee Roth, I'm reminded by the founder of Project Censored, Dr. Carl Jensen. I'm reminded that some of the early criticisms of the project in the late 1970s were about, quote, news judgment, right? And you're very familiar with that phrase. And Carl Jensen actually said, well, that's pretty interesting that we're not necessarily dealing with, quote, gatekeeping or censorship, but rather judgment. However, as Carl quickly discovered, that judgment could be quite poor and, in fact, led him to coin the phrase junk food news to talk about what news media actually covered. But in this context, interestingly enough, this is almost like a built-in, invisible kind of censorship that now we refer to as gatekeeping. But could you talk about the conflation of that with news judgment? What is the kind of bias here that White saw in this type of a study?
The interesting thing, I think, about White's study is what happened almost immediately after it was published. Another researcher, Walter Gieber, decided to conduct a similar study, only this time, instead of looking at just the decisions of a single wire editor, David Manning White's Mr. Gates, Gieber looked at the decisions of 16 different wire editors. So they're making the same kinds of decisions. They work at the same kinds of news organizations, but Gieber is looking at a number of them. Gieber's findings basically refuted what White had concluded previously, that gatekeeping was a subjective, individual decision process. Instead, what Gieber found was that the editors, independently of one another, were making very much the same decisions. So gatekeeping was real, the power of the gatekeeper was real, but the editors were treating story selection not as a matter of pursuing a particular political agenda, but as kind of a professional daily job. Gieber described editors that he studied as being concerned with goals of production and bureaucratic routine. And a number of studies since then have reinforced Gieber's findings that professional assessments of newsworthiness, not political partisanship, guide news workers' decisions about what stories to cover. And I think that finding, although it's a commonplace in, say, the sociology of news media literature, is just an insight that has failed to make any headway in public discussions about news bias more generally. We still see, again and again, discussions driven by the notion of this journalist or this outlet is driven by a personal and sometimes individual agenda politically. And there's just a huge amount of evidence in the field that I have spent most of my life studying, the sociology of news production, to show that that's simply not so. But that understanding of the significance of personal political bias in shaping news content is kind of like a zombie that won't die, despite the evidence to the contrary. But for a long time then, whether you find White's initial analysis compelling or Gieber's more institutionally and organizationally focused study of gatekeeping compelling, it's always been humans that have been the gatekeepers.
This is fascinating because of what we're going to be talking about in a few moments about big tech, Silicon Valley, algorithms, sort of a new type of news filtering. But in your article at themarkaz.org, M-A-R-K-A-Z.O-R-G, you also write about sociologist Michael Shudson, and you talk more about the gatekeeping model as being problematic. Could you introduce that to our listeners?
Like all models or theories in the social sciences, they follow trends, or they enjoy popularity and they fall out of favor, just like fancy restaurants in downtown Los Angeles. The gatekeeping model fell out of favor as other models came onto the scene that seemed to better explain the news production process. And Shudson was one of the people who did a fair amount to discredit the utility of the gatekeeping model. He described it as a handy, if not altogether appropriate, metaphor in a 1989 article, The Sociology of News Production, that's been very influential and republished multiple times. The gatekeeping model, Shudson said, was problematic because it leaves information sociologically untouched. His critique was that gatekeeping treats news as something that comes preformed to an editor, when in fact the production of news is so much more complex and multifaceted and multi-staged than that. And so a model of news gatekeeping that treated the news as if it was preformed was, for Shudson and others, an inadequate model. And part of my argument is that while that was in many ways true of news as it's been produced for decades, if not centuries, in the United States, that under the new conditions that we face now, where algorithmic gatekeeping by big tech companies that don't see themselves as engaged in journalism, they don't even acknowledge that they are media entities, this gatekeeping model now kind of sidesteps some of the Shudson critique, because for these big platforms, for Google, Facebook, and Twitter, who don't produce news stories of their own, news does arrive kind of preformed, and they, in the form of their algorithms, are making decisions about what news stories circulate widely and don't circulate widely.
We're going to get to that element of news production and this new digital era censorship, deplatforming, algorithmic news filtering. But I couldn't help but note the dates around here in the late 80s. Of course, you and I are very aware of Ed Herman and Noam Chomsky's propaganda model coming out of Manufacturing Consent in 1988. How do you see that segueing between these couple of models, Herman, Chomsky? They talk about ownership and advertising and what's newsworthy, right? Who's newsworthy and who's not, newsmakers and shapers and the role of ideology and flack and these kind of things. Where does this fit in, and does this analysis segue into the more algorithmic types of censorship that we're seeing now?
The propaganda model that Herman and Chomsky developed in the late 80s, as you say, was focused on the idea of news being subject to filters. Filters that didn't render the news more clean and healthy, but that rendered it more sterile. The filters that Herman and Chomsky were interested in filtered out anything that would challenge status quo understandings or official narratives about why things are the way they are and why the people in power legitimately deserve to be in power. So in that sense, I think, although Herman and Chomsky, writing in 1989, in the very earliest days of what we know now and take for granted as the internet, didn't talk about algorithmic censorship, I think algorithmic censorship of the sort I'm interested in this article, The New Gatekeepers, is entirely compatible with the propaganda model that Herman and Chomsky advanced. And in fact, Rob Williams, one of our good colleagues, has written about updating the propaganda model to include a number of new 21st century technologies and developments. And I think algorithmic censorship fits right in with what Rob Williams has been writing about.
I'd like to remind our listeners, you're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Right now, we're speaking with the Associate Director of Project Censored, Dr. Andy Lee Roth. We're discussing a recent article just published at the Merkaz Review, The New Gatekeepers, How Proprietary Algorithms Increasingly Determine the News We See. After this brief musical break, we'll learn more about how this happens. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, in this segment, we are joined by the Associate Director of Project Censored, Dr. Andy Lee Roth. We are discussing a recent article just published at the Merkaz Review. That's the Merkaz, MARKAZ.org. The New Gatekeepers, How Proprietary Algorithms Increasingly Determine the News We See. Just a reminder, Andy Lee Roth, again, Associate Director of Project Censored. He coordinates the project's Campus Affiliates Program, which is a news media research network of several hundred students and faculty at 24 colleges and universities across North America. His most recent book, co-edited, is Project Censored, State of the Free Press 2021, out on Seven Stories Press. Andy Lee Roth, before the break, we were talking about a history of gatekeeping and different types of models for understanding news curating, if you will. And we're now getting to the part of your article that talks about algorithmic news filtering. You make some really keen distinctions about the types of past and present filtering, so-called censorship, if you will. So could you talk to us about this algorithmic news filtering in the 21st century?
So the original gatekeeping that we've been discussing is, as I mentioned previously, has always been a human enterprise. It's human decisions, and therefore it was subject to researchers. If they could get access to newsrooms, they could go and they could study directly how editors made decisions about what stories made the news and what stories didn't make the news. The challenge with the new algorithmic gatekeeping, or at least one of the fundamental challenges, is that it's impossible for a contemporary version of a David Manning White or a Walter Gieber to study gatekeeping processes at Google or Facebook. The algorithms that are engaged in the new gatekeeping are protected from public scrutiny. They're considered by the corporations that utilize them to be proprietary intellectual property, and they're guarded carefully as such. And so we end up having to try to study the effects of these algorithms in indirect ways. My colleague April Anderson and I published an article early last year in the Index on Censorship, where one of the things we were looking at how algorithmic content filtering on a variety of online and social media platforms disproportionately affects LGBTQ people and communities. And one of the things we did to try to understand the power of these algorithms was to compare a week's worth of coverage of LGBTQ issues as reported back to us by Google News and DuckDuckGo, another search engine that also aggregates news stories. And what we found when we looked at Google News was that it was remarkably biased in terms of the content that it would report back, that most of the content that rated most highly on Google News, much of it didn't even come from outlets that I would consider to be news organizations. And much of it was far more prejudiced against LGBT people, communities, and issues than any of the contemporary polling we have suggests that public opinion is on those same issues. So incredible bias. It's impossible, though, as we noted in our Index on Censorship article, then it would be impossible to assess whether Google News was biased in those ways because its algorithm is biased, or whether because conservatives with homophobic and transphobic agendas were skillfully gaming the algorithm to promote their own virulent content. That question is not answerable as long as the algorithms are proprietary. It just opens up the whole question of how are decisions made and who or what is making them in a way that I think is incredibly important, not just for people who are interested in the theoretical arguments about how news stories are produced, but also for anyone who's engaged in any kind of activism, especially progressive activism, because this is a powerful but invisible way for most people that content is restricted in exactly the sorts of ways and with just the same consequences as Herman and Chomsky talk about in Manufacturing Consent.
Some of the things that Andy Lee Roth was just talking about, I'm going to make sure that we have them linked at the project page so listeners can go and find some of these other studies, including Andy's work on these issues. Last year, as a result of this research, we did a show with the attorney Peter Obstler, who's involved in a lawsuit against YouTube to find out about these algorithms because there was some shocking information that they found that, in fact, YouTube had admitted that there was an algorithmic connection to what was getting throttled or deplatformed on their sites, much like you were just warning us about. And again, the other issue here is that these are a handful of private corporations claiming proprietary rights over information that is actually a big part of the public sphere, and this runs headlong into the public's right to know the role of a free press and how we need to be accurately informed in order to have meaningful civic engagement. This is a major challenge we have. Ironically, in the so-called information era, we purportedly have information at our fingertips, but how does that information get to the fingertips? And Andy Lee Roth, you pointed out an issue that Project Censored was involved in last year as a co-sponsor of a media literacy conference that was seemingly disappeared from YouTube as an example of how even seemingly innocuous scholarship about these topics can be disappeared on the internet.
That's right. And that was in some ways an impetus for my writing this article. Of course, working with Project Censored for years now, I'm familiar with the idea of online content filtering. But this was the first time that something that I had been involved with had been subject to it. So yeah, this October 2020 conference that Project Censored was a co-sponsor of, along with USC and Stanford, I believe, major organizations with significant academic clout. There was nothing remarkable per se about the content of these panels. And yet, after the conference had concluded, and after the organizers had uploaded video recordings of some 20 hours of conference presentations to a YouTube channel that had been created by the conference organizers to make the sessions available to a wider public, after all that, YouTube removed those conference videos without any notification or explanation. A conference where public scholars and activists were warning about the dangers of media censorship. Ironically, such a conference and those messages were subject to media censorship. And that got me thinking about models for what had happened. And the first that I sort of thought about was in George Orwell's dystopian novel, 1984, how technology that people who use it refer to as memory holes. It's an ironic naming, because of course the things that are dumped in the memory holes are any kind of documentation or evidence of positions or events that might conflict with or undermine the dystopian government's interests as determined by the Ministry of Truth. So, you know, it felt a little bit like this critical media literacy conference had been subjected to a digital memory hole. But as I thought about it further, that's when I really came on to the idea that no, this was actually this new form of an old model, a new form of gatekeeping. The concept that White and Geber had developed in the 50s was newly applicable.
By the way, you also mentioned, in addition to the algorithmic censorships, you do mention more of the old form of deplatforming, mentioning these tech companies deplatforming then-President Donald Trump, suspending Parler, a popular site where many Trump supporters would go. And you aptly point out that these were clearly human decisions. So we're dealing with multiple avenues of censorship or deplatforming here.
And I think the significant thing about the deplatforming of Trump and many of his supporters and the suspension of Parler after the January 6th assault on the Capitol, there were two things about those that I think are very important to understand to differentiate that kind of media control from what I'm calling the new gatekeeping. As you point out, Mickey, those were human decisions. They were reported in the news And it wasn't the focus of the stories about those decisions that humans had made them, but that was implicit in the coverage. The other thing is they were reported as newsworthy events in their own right. They were treated, as C. Wright Mills, the sociologist, would say, as public issues, things that concerned more than the immediate circle of people who were directly involved in them. They mattered to the society as a whole. By contrast, though, the kinds of things that I'm calling the new gatekeeping are stories that may be well known to listeners of the Project Censored radio show, but have not enjoyed the kind of widespread media attention that the deplatforming of Donald Trump by Twitter or the suspension of Parler received. So I'm thinking about issues like how independent news outlets have documented the ways in which Twitter, Facebook, and others have suspended the accounts of Venezuelan, Iranian, and Syrian users who have been posting content that conflicts with U.S. foreign policy. As I mentioned, April Anderson and I have written about how the Google News aggregator filters out pro-LGBTQ stories while amplifying homophobic and transphobic voices, and also how changes made by Facebook to its news feed effectively throttled web traffic to progressive news outlets like Mother Jones. In each of those cases, the decisions have not been treated as public issues. They haven't been reported on as such. The decisions to filter content have not been widely appreciated. And this is the heart of the argument. Those decisions weren't made by humans, or at least they weren't made directly by humans. They were made by algorithms. And so increasingly, the news is a product of both the daily routines and professional judgments of journalists, editors, and other news professionals, but also the product of the assessments of relevance and appropriateness that are being made on a daily, hourly, you know, moment by moment basis by artificial intelligence programs that we don't know very much about. But we do know they're controlled by private for-profit corporations that don't see themselves as engaged in journalism and therefore not responsible to the kind of ethical standards of good journalism.
Well, Andy Lee Roth, near the end of your article at themarkaz.org, it's a special issue on the truth or why truth, a fascinating series of articles, yours among them. You write that there are critical studies of algorithmic bias, and you point out to readers some of the key scholars that are trying to help us understand this, including Sophia Noble's Algorithms of Oppression. She was one of the people that spoke at the Critical Media Literacy Conference of the Americas that was disappeared. You mentioned Virginia Eubanks' Automating Inequality, Kathy O'Neill's Weapons of Mass Destruction. And you go on to talk about how we don't just need to sit around and wait for others to try to tackle this problem for us. What can we do in response to algorithmic gatekeeping? And you recommend four proactive responses. Could you share these things that we can all be doing?
The first one is to avoid using Google as a verb. And I want to give a shout out to our colleague, Emil Marmol, who at that very conference alerted me to this kind of thing that we all do, right? It's a common habit to say, oh, I'll Google that. And when we use our language that way, when we talk about a generic online activity using the brand name of a corporation, we're reinforcing the status quo. There's something ironic about using the term Google to talk about a way of seeking information where we're using the very name of a company that is in many ways controlling and filtering the kinds of information that we can find for ourselves, even as Google, of course, is sharing all kinds of information about us with other entities who are willing to pay for that information. Let's not use Google as a verb and think about using search engines other than Google. This is the second point I make, a recommendation for a proactive response to these issues, things we can do now, today, on our own. Remember that search engines and social media feeds aren't neutral information sources. The algorithms that drive them often serve to reproduce existing inequalities in just the ways that Sophia Noble, Virginia Eubanks, and Kathy O'Neill and others show us that algorithms that appear to be objective and therefore viewpoint neutral, it's so easy to build into them long-standing human prejudices, adding in effect new layers to structural inequalities. Third, I think it's important to connect directly to the news organizations that you believe display firm commitments to ethical journalism. In other words, don't rely on social media feeds to get your news. I recommend going to the outlet's website, signing up for the outlet's email list or its RSS feed, subscribing to it if it has a print edition.
So, Andy Lee Roth, you have the four proactive responses: avoid using Google as a verb. You recommend moving from Google to, say, DuckDuckGo as an example. Connect directly to news organizations that display firm commitments to ethical journalism. And then last, you call for one other thing regarding algorithms.
Yeah, calling out algorithmic bias when you encounter it. In some ways, my whole article is me doing just this. I was at this Critical Media Literacy Conference of the Americas, as were you, Mickey, and many of our colleagues, and important insights that I think are well worth sharing. It's at least hard now, if not impossible, to find these things via YouTube. This article is partly me doing what I'm recommending others do. Call it out directly, both to the entity responsible for the algorithmic censorship, but also calling it out publicly by letting others know about it.
Andy Lee Roth, I'm reminded every time we have these types of conversations, I'm reminded of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the EFF.org, their tools page from the tech team. They give us ways that we can try to protect privacy and security online. And EFF.org has a number of these: privacy badger, cert bot, covering your tracks, surveillance self-defense. Really useful things to protect ourselves online as much as possible. Andy Lee Roth, Associate Director of Project Censored, co-editor most recently of Project Censored State of the Free Press 2021. I'd like to thank you for joining us once again on the Project Censored show. Anything else you'd like to add here?
Just thinking of algorithmic literacy as part of our critical media literacy toolkit is essential. And so anything we can do, and this article is my modest effort to try to raise public awareness about the power of algorithms, in this case, the power of algorithms to control the sorts of news we see. Anything we can do to increase people's algorithmic literacy enhances their critical media literacy, and that in turn contributes to creating the conditions for genuine, robust self-government.
Andy Lee Roth, author most recently of an article at the Markaz Review, "The New Gatekeepers: How Proprietary Algorithms Increasingly Determine the News We See." Thanks once again for joining us on the Project Censored show today.
Thanks, Mickey.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaigns.
You've been listening to the Project Censored show, established in 2010 by myself along with Peter Phillips. I'm the executive producer, Mickey Huff, of this program. Also the host, Anthony Fest, our senior producer. Thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
Political ties, habitual eyes, alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics of the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burn bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little poison. The weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the prisons and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens. Hypnotized by the master thief, combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love.